The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. So it'll be PSG, Manchester City and Real Madrid, Chelsea in the semi-finals of the Champions League. Jude Bellingham scares City before the vastly more experienced Phil Foden wins it. How did Pep get it right? Not overthinking it, just thinking it, perhaps. And does this mean Foden is better than Sterling? And does that mean that Sterling has to go to West Ham? Liverpool knock at Real Madrid's door repeatedly, but no one from the wily old stages lets them in. So who's going to win the competition? And are Real Madrid the good guys? Troy Townsend will join us as we discuss Andre Kudela's 10-game ban for racism. It's 10 years of the WSL. Has it been a good decade? Susie Rack will tell us. All that, a weekend preview, your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Mark Langdon of the Racing Post. Welcome.
Hello, Max.
Hello, Nicky Bandini.
Morning.
And hello, Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
Let's start then with Borussia Dortmund 1. Manchester City 2. Vaguely interesting stat from producer Joel, who fills the script with incredibly uninteresting stats that I edit out in the morning. In the Champions League history, the side winning the first leg of a knockout stage tie 2-1 at home have been eliminated more often than they've progressed. So well done to Manchester City for overcoming that. Should we praise them, Mark, for overcoming initially what looked like it might be another City quarterfinal, because they started so cautiously and so unlike Manchester City play?
Yeah, I think you do deserve praise when you reach the semi-final of the Champions League. Of Borussia Dortmund made life difficult. They've not done very well in the Bundesliga this season, but you look at that team on paper and they are capable of causing any team problems. They were 2-0 up at Bayern Munich not that long ago. So it rarely going to be easy in the quarterfinal of the Champions League. And you're right that they did start slowly and they did suffer the setback. And so often, actually, in the Champions League, Man City have sort of crumbled under those setbacks and conceded not just one goal, but a second one has usually followed. You go back to the Anfield sort of debacle when they were 3-0 down after half an hour. Son had scored twice inside 15 minutes at the Etihad. Monaco got three away goals when they knocked them out. So they have been prone to those just collapses, really, in the Champions League. But By half time, you felt like they'd grown into the game. They had created opportunities, and you know, over not only that game but the two legs, they fully deserved to go through. And I thought it was a good performance from them, given sort of some of the wobbles they'd had in previous Champions League encounters.
Nicky?
Yeah, I mean, I guess one of the big criticisms that we've heard a lot of Pep in these situations, in these Champions League quarterfinals specifically, is he gets this point of overthinking himself, where he seems to have felt in past seasons like he has to mirror other teams. I think there was a lot of talk about that after Lyon last season, coming up with this inexplicable, untested 3-5-2. And I guess the season before that against Tottenham, just finding the most Spursy way to lose was what he did to mirror Tottenham. Just really set yourself up to go through and then find a way not to. But yeah, this has been the idea with Pep, that he overthinks things, that he gets too into the detail of individual opponents, and it's almost that he's outthinks himself. And even former players have talked about this. Thomas Müller talked about that when he was at Bayern, not really critiquing him, not criticizing him, actually sort of saying, look, he's a really advanced thinker in how he thinks about football, but he can get into this. And is it possible that Dortmund were just really easy for Pep to do that with, you know, compared to some of the other teams that you might line up against? Because Dortmund in lots of ways want to play like City, actually. Dortmund want to do the same sort of football that City do, but aren't as good at it. And both teams kind of are quite comfortable to line up in a 4-3-3, for instance. It's not actually necessarily Dortmund's natural wheelhouse, but when you take out Sancho, it's something they've gone to before. I think maybe this was a very comfortable matchup for City, much more so than what they're going to face in the next round, I think, even against PSG.
I like the idea, Barry, that the real success is when Pep underthinks things or doesn't bother even thinking at all. You know, that he's got to such a stage where really what they're telling him to do is stop thinking and just, you know, or not bother, and then he'll be absolutely fine. Ian says, and I think this is more a question for Mark, but I'll throw it to Barry, which is more mouthwatering, A, deep-fried butter dipped in lard, or B, Phil Foden. But Baz, Foden has been like crucial for these two games, hasn't he? You know, not single-handedly won them the tie, but being like the linchpin.
You know, we extol his virtues on this podcast on a regular basis. There's not a huge amount left to say about him. He's very good. If I was an England fan, I'd be really happy to see, you know, that two of the key players in this tie were a 17-year-old Englishman and a 20-year-old Englishman who may not even make the first team at the Euros, Gareth Southgate's first team. I suspect Foden will. I'd be bewildered if he doesn't. But I'm not sure what more there is to say about him. He looks like the finished article, even though he's only 20 years old. There's very little he can't do.
I think it's interesting, isn't it, with Foden? Like Baz saying, you can't imagine him not being in that England team. And I think for a long time, a lot of people looked at the City team and thought, you can't imagine why, even as good as City are, why he's not getting more minutes. I mean, it's only a year or two ago, he's on England under-21 duty and giving these pretty sort of snarky comments at times about, I'm not getting any minutes at City, so it's a good thing I get a chance over here. But clearly, despite all that, never was sort of interested in leaving, always wanted to be at City, always clearly had this great relationship with Guardiola. And I guess it was one of the narratives coming into this tie. Unfortunately, Sancho wasn't there yesterday, but this idea that you had these two who started off together and then went their separate ways, and one got to play a lot of minutes early and the other one didn't. And a couple of years down the line, well, they're both doing great, actually. They're both doing absolutely fine. So maybe we don't really get any learning point from that in terms of one route being better than the other.
Before, Max, in your... you don't normally do it, but for some reason you threw to me with the question about a comparison of butter and a man. I was just thinking, I was wondering if possibly is there a case to be argued that Borussia Dortmund, and this is something Wilson comes out with occasionally, did they score too early? Because Manchester City were playing not particularly badly, but not with any great ambition in the opening 15 minutes. And then as soon as Bellingham scored, it was like a switch had been flicked and they just, you know, electroshocked them into, oh, crikey, we better do something here. And
what minute do you think they should have scored in?
Well, that's what I'm wondering. Like, when is... Because at some point you're going to be leaving it a bit too late. But I think if they had just kept City at arm's length as they did until Bellingham scored... And then the pace after that was just absolutely frantic, and there was no way both teams were going to be able to keep that up for over an hour, and so it came to pass.
I think it's great that Baz used the phrase arm's length there, because all I've got in my head is, if Emre Can just keeps the ball, maybe not right next to his arm, then this tie could go very differently. I mean, it was a bizarre way to let City back in, really.
I don't think that made that much of a difference, to be honest. I think City, they were not going to lose that game.
Do you think? But still, you do wonder what Emre Can's doing. I initially thought that isn't a penalty because he headed it first. Dale Johnson, who's a good man to go to ESPN, said, look, the ball deflecting off the body onto the arm does not cancel a penalty if the defender's arm is extended well away from the body. I mean, he could have just kicked it. But I suppose once you start leaning, then you're just leaning, aren't you? And then you think, well, I better keep leaning. Chris says, if a player falls in the forest and there's nobody else around, does Peter Walton believe it's a penalty? Because on BT in the UK, they crossed to Peter Walton, who said, that isn't a penalty. And then VAR decided it was a penalty. And then everyone said, yes, the rule is that is a penalty. And Peter Walton just carried on sitting in that little box that he sits in.
I mean... Peter Walton's become quite the figure of fun in recent months since he started working for BT because of how many things he gets wrong. But I do find it generally worrying, because I'm not one of these people who has conspiracy theories about referees, and I am one of these people who think they do their best, they know what they're doing, but they are doing their best under difficult circumstances and occasionally make mistakes. He doesn't appear to have a clue what he's talking about. And he had quite a distinguished career as a referee. And that that frightens me. Like, how many more people like him are there out there refereeing football matches?
There are lots of laws. That's why none of us have read them, because there's just so many.
I've read them,
isn't it? Have you all of them?
Yeah.
Have you read them, Nikki?
I have. Not necessarily Sam read them in one go, but I've had to go through them quite a few times, so probably I've read them all over time.
Oh, wow. Mark?
It's not something I do on a regular basis, mate. I would occasionally, if I feel like I'm sort of on my own with, you know, watching a decision and sort of going against the general opinion, I will refer back to the laws just to make sure that I am wrong. Usually I am.
I need to get the laws. I'm the one here.
It's
the outlier.
It's good toilet reading. You can just pick it up, put it down, dip in and out.
How impressive, Mark, was it that City kept Erling Braut Haaland quiet for essentially for both legs? He set up one in the first leg, but he didn't have the impact on...
He set up in this leg.
Yes, okay, that's true.
They kept him on a really tight rein, didn't they, Max?
Well, I think they did.
Played a key part in both goals they conceded.
I still think they did. Do you, Mark? Maybe I'm wrong. I thought I have seen Haaland do more in other games.
Yeah, I mean, he has done more in other games. I mean, usually when Borussia Dortmund play, as long as it's not against Bayern Munich, and even when it's against Bayern, I suppose he gets more opportunities. So that would be a rare kind of game for him, and probably would have been one that maybe teams that are looking to buy Haaland would sort of... How does he done against Manchester City when Dortmund aren't attacking as much and they're not creating as many chances? And actually, I think he did show other sides to his game with the assist in the first game and the way he kind of helped Bellingham get the second goal as well. And so there probably was more to take out of Haaland's sort of two-legged performance because we know he can score goals. He scored a lot of them already. But this was a different side to him where, you know, Dortmund were struggling and I still felt he did well. He's definitely not underrated, I think it's fair to say. And there's a lot of hype around him and some of it does get a little bit too much for me. But he's definitely, I think, shown in the games against City that he's capable of doing more than just score goals.
We've touched on Jude Bellingham, but he was, even before he scored, I mean, the guy, Nikki, is just effortless as a footballer, isn't he?
Oh, he's really exciting to watch and a bit sort of... mind-boggling to think he's 17 years old. I always find it, there's that awkward moment when a player that age in English scores because they'll always bring up the list of youngest English Champions League goal scorers. And every time, maybe this is just me with like my embedded Arsenal neuroses, every time I see those lists and I see Theo Walcott on them, I think, all right, well, there's your reminder not to get ahead of yourself and assume that someone's going to become everything that you hope for them and are projecting onto them, because sometimes it doesn't go quite, not that Walcott had a terrible career, but doesn't go quite the way that you imagine when someone's that age and doing something. But he's really a beautiful footballer to watch. And I thought it was something probably encouraging from a coaching standpoint in his reaction after the game as well, because he was interviewed on BT Sport and they were asking him, oh, you know, wasn't that a great night? And he was like, well, it's not a great night when you lose. I don't care about scoring a goal when I lose. And I think probably that's exactly what managers want to hear from a young player who could be getting ahead of himself and could be getting egotistical about doing something like that.
City play PSG in the semi-final then. It's Pep's first semi-final as a Manchester City manager. He's got to the same number of semi-finals as Jose Mourinho now. So that's good for him, isn't it? Let's go to Anfield then. Liverpool 0, Real Madrid 0. Baz, Liverpool started this game brilliantly. I almost moved them from the laptop to the telly. I almost did a swap because of how well Liverpool began this game. But you just got the feeling they were never going to score.
I didn't think Liverpool really threatened Real Madrid yesterday. There was that Mo Salah miss in the second minute, which was quite surprising. You would expect him to score that most of the time, but I didn't think. I thought their performance was a little like Porto's against Chelsea. They did okay, but never really looked in much doubt the ultimate outcome.
The front three, Mark, aren't as good as they were a couple of years ago. Is that, you know, is is that form is temporary, class is permanent, and they'll come back in a year or two, or is it time to ship them all off and get some new ones?
I wouldn't get rid of all of them. I was surprised that Jota didn't start. I felt that he's done enough really over sort of the last few, well, since he signed for Liverpool, to say that he could and should be ahead of Firmino. I know that Firmino does some good work with the linking, but even that wasn't really there last night. There were a couple of moments where he could have played in a teammate and maybe he would have done 18 months ago, and the pass just wasn't there. So I was, like I said, I was surprised really with the team selection. Even in midfield, I felt that Thiago, that was a game that was crying out for somebody that could get on the ball and try to make something happen, because particularly in the second half, Liverpool became a bit like sort of David Moyes' sort of Manchester United team, where they got it wide and put crosses into absolutely nobody. They didn't even have a Fellaini there. And there was that bit right at the end where Klopp got really frustrated. With like, how many times are we going to do this? In sort of the 93rd minute, where just another aimless cross went in. And I felt like they needed to be a bit smarter on the ball, really, because Real Madrid were sat in. I disagree with Barry in terms of the chances. I felt that not only the Salah one, Wijnaldum had a really good opportunity just before half time, and maybe that will have sort of changed the dynamic of the tie. But there is a lack of efficiency up front for sure, and it's not just been in this game. This has been going on for several months, and I think it will be a concern definitely for Jurgen Klopp, because all the focus has been on the issues at the back. But the front three haven't got the team out of trouble often enough.
Barney Ronay writing about Phillips and Kabak, saying at least they're slow in different ways. Kabak in the more muscular, controlled way. Phillips, gangly, slow, moving into top gear with all the grace of a collapsing scaffold. Thing is, Nicky, you know, thing about injuries is you sort of, for about four or five games when you're missing a player, you say, look, it's really key. And then we kind of like move on as if that doesn't matter anymore. But like, it's a big deal. Like, it's a big deal not having Van Dijk and Gomez and Matip and Henderson. I mean, I know Real Madrid, of course, are missing a bunch of players as well.
I mean, that's the thing with that argument, isn't it? You can cut it the other way and say Real Madrid, I think Ferland Mendy was the only member of their back four who would be first choice normally. So I think there's been all sorts of those sorts of underlying factors that probably haven't got as much attention as they could have done. I think that fixture congestion at certain times hit certain teams really hard all over Europe and has made a huge difference. And maybe even Real Madrid and how they started this season. Real Madrid were awful at a certain point in the group stage. They barely got through after, well, in the end, it kind of got comfortable because of everyone else in the group, but they did lose to Shakhtar twice. I think there's all sorts of those factors going on. And it's like actually the other thing, which I guess everyone was talking about after this game, or I heard a lot of anyway, was this issue of Liverpool suddenly not being able to win at the Kop, not being able to score goals at the Kop. And my mind went back actually to like a really old Football Weekly. I can't remember how many years ago this would be, but we were talking about...
If it was before 2016, it's been struck from the record as far as Max is concerned.
Well, let's just say a conversation with Greg Ruffley then, or Greg Bukowski. I think that might tell you how long ago this conversation
was.
Talking about why home advantage still seems to matter, even though certainly in the Premier League, we're not really talking about atmospheres that are so hot all the time, that are so sort of on top of you. And Greg made this analogy of like, oh, it's just like, you know, when you're at home, you know where the kettle is, you know where you can get your cup of tea, you just know where everything is and that's comfortable and that makes a difference to you. And I was sort of just had that analogy pop into my head and I thought, is there a little bit like some of us are experiencing now of, after a year of pandemic, being at home feels suffocating, like I just need to get out of this box that I've been in, and is that how it's starting to feel for Liverpool players in an empty cup? Like, oh God, I just want to be anywhere else than this this sort of enforced home that we've put up with for a long time.
Yeah, I think we'd have to go back in time, not have the pandemic, and then have two different, like Back to the Future, like the almanac one and the non-almanac one, and we could see who wins the league with fans and who without.
Can we
arrange tricky
that?
To organise, but we'll see what we can do. Liverpool have condemned the fans who smashed the Real Madrid coach window as it was driving into Anfield. We condemn unequivocally the actions that led to Real Madrid's team bus being damaged during its arrival to Anfield this evening. It's totally unacceptable and shameful behaviour of a few individuals. Yes, like, don't throw things at a coach. I mean, it's It's not rocket science, is it? So Real Madrid played Chelsea in the semi-final. They've never played each other in the Champions League before. Max asks, if Chelsea are considered to be the plucky, likeable underdogs of the Champions League semi-finalists, is the only way to enjoy the rest of the tournament to lean into schadenfreude knowing three of the four will not win? Nicholas, has there ever been a group of four more unlikable teams than Chelsea, Man City, PSG and Real Madrid? We sort of touched on it yesterday, Barry, didn't we? I mean, it's the nature of football. I wonder if one of the skills with sports washing, and look, all four teams are slightly different, but just the idea of sports washing, one of the successes is it becomes boring talking about it because I want to talk about football, that's where sports washing succeeds, because you just go, oh, I don't want someone else to mention this team that I shouldn't like because I know I shouldn't like them, or I know I should question their ownership.
Well, a lot of people don't question their ownership, and that's the problem. And these people are fans of these clubs who do not give a shit about them. I woke up this morning to an absolutely deranged email from a Manchester City fan who took grave exception to the fact that I'd, you know, made a waspish comment about the lineup of the semi-finals in my minute-by-minute report last night, and you know, talked about how what a romantic lineup it was to have these plucky underdogs in the last four. He, you know, it was an exercise in venality, or not venality, in just, it was nasty, it was spiteful, it was an exercise in total whataboutery, just ill-informed gibberish. And I'm really looking forward to these two semi-finals. I'm not looking forward to the build-up, because you can't get away from the fact that two of the teams in this semi-finals who are playing each other are owned by countries that are run by tyrannies, and you cannot not mention that.
Mark?
Yeah, I think it's really strange here, but Real Madrid are the most sort of, I suppose, likeable in some respects of the quartet. And, you know, for so long, Real Madrid were, you know, the Galacticos and spending sort of grotesque amounts of money. But actually, they haven't done that. I mean, this season, they didn't buy one player in the summer. And they, you know, for financial reasons, got rid of a lot of kind of the squad men. So Reguilón went, Hakimi left for Inter, you know, Bale and James Rodriguez were another two that departed. And the squad is really thin. And if you go through it player for player, most people would kind of go, well, you know, in terms of like the real quality, it's not really there. And you know, someone like Modric over the hill, Kroos not as good as he was, you know, Ramos is coming towards the end and stuff like this. But yet, actually, they've found a way to get to the Champions League semi-finals, and maybe they are sort of different this season anyway to some of the others. I mean, Chelsea, I think, spent the most, didn't they, in Europe this summer, and Real Madrid did not spend €1 on a new player. So
yeah, it's interesting. I like the idea of, you know, on just before the final, and they interview you. This is Luca. He's a dustman by day, but he plays central midfield for Real Madrid by night. But I take
it's
your
very
point.
Much, it's very much the narrative around them, and I've sort of, you know, been one of those that sort of hasn't given Zidane probably as much credit as he deserves, and I would sort of, you know, always question, well, like, what's the long-term project and where's the process? But he does get results, and, you know, there's something to be said, I think, for the way that he's achieved that, sort of in a really difficult summer for them, where they're not playing their home games at the Bernabeu, they've not signed a player, and here they are, you know, I think many people would now put them favourites for La Liga, and they're in the semi-finals of the Champions League.
Europa League tonight, the biggest story, of course, is Manchester United changing the colour of the banners covering the seats at Old Trafford from red to black in an effort to win more home games. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer saying some of the players have mentioned that split-second decision you have to make where you look over your shoulder and see if your teammate is there or not. The red shirt is on a red background with red seats. Thomas says, with this news, how long before teams start changing the banners on seats each week to match the shirt colour of the opposition? And then they'll second guess about away kits or not, and suddenly you'll just see people, stewards, running around changing the banners to the colour of the kit that the away team have turned up in. Anyway, the Europa League is tonight. We might mention it on Monday if anything interesting happens. That'll do for part one. Part two, Troy Townsend will join us, and we'll talk about Andre Kudela and his 10-game ban for racism. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. So Slavia Prague's Andre Kudel has been banned for 10 matches after racially abusing Glenn Kamara, with the Rangers midfielder suspended for 3 games for assaulting Kudela in the tunnel after the game. Kamara's account was supported by his Rangers teammates, Bongani Zungu, and UEFA's Control Ethics and Disciplinary Body found Kudela guilty of using racist language. Troy Townsend from Kick It Out joins us. Hey, Troy. Nice to see you. How are you doing?
Yeah, not too bad, Max. Not too bad. Glad to be rolled out again.
Yeah. Listen, you're very good. It's very good of you to come on and discuss these things. One day I said, Troy, you and I will do a podcast on 90s music. One
you
day
did.
We will.
Yeah, you did.
And one day it'll happen. I mean, no one will listen to it, Troy, but, you know, it's a dream of ours. So, look, what I've seen your reaction on Twitter, but what was your reaction to this?
Yeah, you saw my reaction. That was the mellowed down version, I think, to be honest, Max. You know, I always think that we tend, well, personally, let me not speak for anyone else. You kind of live in hope that the same mistakes would not be made and made again by, you know, the governing bodies of our game. So you think that at some stage they really are going to take matters seriously and hand out a punishment that shocks us all. You know, I don't know if you remember. Do you remember the Champions League cat?
Yeah.
A couple of seasons ago that got fined, the Besiktas got fined 30,000 euros. And you kind of think to yourself, you know, let's go all out here, UEFA. You know what I mean? Let's double what that cat's got and let's, you know, really put a sanction in. And I'm sorry to make a joke of it all, but it is a joke. It's a farce. He's been found guilty. I thought it was a real cowardly way what he did there. And I'm not even mentioning his name today. Real cowardly what he did to Kamara there. Something that he'd obviously thought about as well. I don't think that's a spontaneous moment. I think that's playing on someone's mind that at some stage, because of how heated the game was as well, he was going to target one of the Rangers' black players. So to give him the minimum punishment, to make one of those punishments a game that he was never going to play in anyway because he refused to come to England, although it was said that he wasn't well. Those games are covered by European Euro 2020 games anyway. So actually, it's going to finish a lot quicker than what it would have done, even if he's not selected for, well, if he's selected for the Euros. I just, honestly, when you put it all together, it, again, I was going to say speechless, but I'm talking quite a lot, aren't I? So I'm not speechless. But it just leaves me wondering where we go at this stage.
Troy, do you think that UEFA's reluctance to hand out a serious punishment, is it something to do with the fact that they think if we hand out a serious punishment, that means we're acknowledging racism is a big problem and we don't want to do that because it's bad for the image?
It's a great question, Barry. But, you know, on every Champions League game and whatever else it may be, there's a little logo on the left-hand side of everyone's sleeve, isn't there, that says, say no to racism. You know, and if that's the only thing that they have as an image of their way of showing that we mean business here, then that's not enough. I actually think they're frightened that if they set a precedent in something like this case, you know, a minimum sanction, or sorry, a sanction that goes above and beyond what anyone has done in football, by the way, anyone. So that includes us as well in this country. So let's not sit on our high horse about this. Then that they're going to have to continue to follow through. And I don't think they want to follow through on those actions. You know, for me, a message of banned until further notice, banned until meeting certain requirements. You know, things like that need to come into play. I saw Kamara's agent yesterday saying he was expecting a year. Now, whilst I was really pleased with what he said, I'm also thinking, well, I don't know where he's got that from. Why would he ever expect a year? It's never been in UEFA's kind of rule book. I don't know how many pages it's got, but that they would, you know, sanction someone for a year. But is that what it takes, Barry? But yeah, listen, everyone looks at sponsors, everyone looks at the credibility of the organisation and then the competition, and that all plays on their mind. Let's not get this twisted. That plays on their mind without doubt.
Johnny Liu wrote a brilliant piece, Troy, about the victim in a situation like this, who in the milliseconds after an incident, while dealing with kind of shock, anger, sadness, has to be taking notes in their head about exactly what's happened for when it's investigated. And it really articulated it brilliantly about us trying to get to a stage where a victim is believed.
The piece was outstanding, to be totally honest. But I tell you now, I bet you the people who should have been reading that piece were not reading the piece. I don't think the victim is at the forefront. When you know, these organisations are putting together their plan of how, you know, once they've read all their submissions and put together their plan of how they're going to treat the perpetrator, do I think that they actually think about the impact of, you know, whatever abuse it is, but in this case it's racial abuse, on an individual? Do they really appreciate the fact that Slavia Prague escalated the impact on Kamara by calling him a liar publicly, which then has led to him every single day since that game receiving more abuse from on social media platforms, which also you must have been aware of the banner that the Slavia Prague fans put out and the wording that was on that banner. So I'm going to say here, not only should UEFA have been considering what ban they were going to do to the player, they should also have been considering what action they were going to take against the football club, because the football club condoned the behaviour. So at that moment, we should be talking about multiple offences here. They condone the behaviour. But going back to your kind of question, Max, that lived experience never goes away from you. That lived experience of being, you know, like I said, it was a cowardly thing that the player did to Kamara. That lived experience is now going to stay not only with him, with his immediate family, because of all the fallout now, the way he's been targeted, the thought process of thinking, I wonder if it's going to happen again. You know what? You know, this game's a bit heated. I wonder if that's going to happen again. Just in your everyday life now, experiences like that never go away. Never, ever go away. You try to push them to the back of your mind. You try to think to yourself, I'm not going to let this get the better of me. But I tell you now, you've got to be some person to be able to do that. And do I think UEFA have thought about that? Not at all. Not at all.
And do you think, or how do you navigate, and in this situation, Kamara was, you know, his account was supported by a teammate. But when you have the situation when it's one person's word against another, and I've heard so many people say, well, how can you make a judgment? Because you don't know, because we don't know what's said. How do you navigate that?
Yeah, but Max, of course that is difficult. But all I would say to you, why does it always lean towards the person that has done the deed? Why is that always the fact then that the victim has to prove that he's been victimised, they've been victimised, and go through that experience? You know, you just spoke about Jonathan Liu's piece. Mm. Go through all the experience that has created in an instance, but then relive it, recount it, run through the whole process again. You know, so, it is a difficult thing. And I would say, but at no point does it weigh in favour of the victim. It always weighs in favour of the perpetrator. And for me, that's not balance. That's not correct. So now I have to, you know, I'll use me as an example. I have to now put together everything that happened in the build-up, at the moment, and afterwards to prove sure. that I've been racially abused. He called him an F monkey. You know, if that is still allowed in 2020, okay, in our game of football, then what you are going to have, and I think Kamara said it, should have walked off. That's what's going to happen. It's going to set a precedent now where players, clubs, because of the support that Kamara received, you know, in that moment will think, well, what's the point? Nothing happens. Look what happened to Glenn. You know, he didn't really, I know he's had to live through this. It's better off that we go and then we'll fight in the courts. Simple as that. And we, again, Max, we saw what happened in Spain recently as well, didn't we? When Valencia walked off and walked back on again. These are the things that are happening at the moment, you know, and it's a tough one. But I don't see that at any stage that the situation, and I'm using benefits, but I probably don't mean benefits, but weighs on the victim's side. And I wouldn't want anyone to have to go through the experience of reaccounting experiences like what Glenn Kamara had to.
Troy, you spoke just when you come on first, you made light of the fact that you were being wheeled out again. Do you ever wish you hadn't put yourself in the spotlight to fight this battle?
God, Barry, what a tough one that is. Listen, there are massive low moments when you're fighting discrimination. There are low moments when you're talking up on behalf of many that don't have a platform and don't have a voice, to be totally honest. I'll be honest with you, there were periods at the back end of last year because of a certain documentary and the way that I was accused of, you know, going against the FA, or I was accused of lying. Basically, I was accused of lying when I actually thought, time's up, enough's enough, I can't do this. You know, my evidence, everything that I say and everything that I give is factual, by the way. So when I speak because I do my homework. I speak because I make sure I'm aware of what's going on around me. But it's almost like a responsibility that I've taken on without accepting it. But I'm glad to continue to do it, because the amount of people that touch base with me, Barry, to be totally honest, and the amount of people that drive me on to continue to speak in this space where they feel that their voices would never be heard. So it was, I am making light of it because I do have other attributes. I know no one really appreciates that, but I, you know, there's little bits about
steady on,
I
can, steady on, Troy.
I could add value in, you know, I know how to score a goal. I know what it, I know how to dissect a game, but no, listen, no, I've had low moments that have said to me, maybe you should step away, Troy. There's got to be an easier life somewhere else. But ultimately, I appreciate and value my responsibility in this space, Barry.
What do you make of some football clubs stepping away from social media for a week? Sort of my instant reaction was, at least they're doing something. I don't imagine Mark Zuckerberg is going to be, you know, losing sleep over it.
No, I'm proud of the clubs. It's a stance. It's a stance that no one else has taken at the moment, but you're absolutely right. Does it register on the thick Richter scale of Facebook? I nearly swore then. Do you know that? Does it register?
Okay, you're allowed to on this.
How are you? Right, okay.
Yeah, go for your life. I should have told you that a couple of years ago, Troy.
Yeah, exactly.
That's some fruitier podcasts.
I mean, does it register really on the Richter scale of Facebook and Insta? Does football register on the Richter scale? To be honest, absolutely not. Absolutely not. So I'm proud of the clubs because, you know, it means that the conversation continues, and it means that actually other clubs might be saying, have you seen what Swansea have done? Have you seen what Birmingham have done? And I know there's conversations in the Premier League, and I know there's conversations in the EFL about potential of, you know, a total blackout from the clubs. Yeah, listen, we've been talking in this space about social media now for forever and a day. Nothing's changed. We're talking about the same things now that we were talking about 10 years ago. Filtering systems and you know, ID systems and all this stuff. They're the same conversations from 10. If you had had me on 10 years ago, Max, I would have said the same thing that I'm saying today. So those social media companies are in control of what they want to do, and they're playing with us. They're playing with the football clubs. They're playing with us as the general public. They're playing with anyone that has been victimized on their platforms because they have the power and the know-how. They're multi-billion dollar businesses, tech industry. Don't tell me that something couldn't have been done 5 years ago. That means you would not need to be speaking to me about this now.
Do you, on this, and I've really, I'm not sure what the right thing to do is. At the moment, I feel, you know, any black Asian player has a bad game or loses or doesn't even have a bad game or wins, they'll probably get racially abused on a social media platform. Then people like us, radio stations, TV channels, report it, and then nothing gets done. And then that just shows to everyone else, you can do this and you are free to do this. And I wonder if it's right to keep saying, this player got racially abused last week, this player did last week. And because until the social media companies do something, all you're doing is saying, if you want to go and be racist to someone, you can. But if you don't report it, then you're ignoring the problem. I'm conflicted.
Yeah, but we're not the ones that should be judged here. Or the media are not the ones that should be judged here. Or football's not the ones that should be judged here. It's the social media platforms. So anyone that wants to, and I know there are players who are just fed up, who actually have said, oh yeah, I've got racially abused, but you know, I'm just keeping it to myself now. There's no point. I'm just keeping it to myself. While there are some that want to be proactive and vocal and want stuff done about it. You know, we should not be judging the player's right to either identify or to keep to themselves the abuse that they receive. We have obligations in the industry to either raise it and keep raising it. And I know that there were situations that happened last night as well, after a certain Champions League game. And I won't say it because I'm saying it out of respect for the football club today and the enormity of what today is for that football club. But they have their own right. Those players have their own right. And we have to choose as people working in the industry, as the media, how we amplify the voices and keep the pressure on. And I wouldn't judge anybody for you know, saying, I'm going to take a break today. You know, I'm not going to highlight that because what's the point? I'll say this, though. West Bromwich Albion's famous victory against Chelsea, and it is a famous victory, by the way, and I hope there's no Chelsea supporters on here today, also turned out to be one really bad day for one of the goal scorers. Because after scoring, so you said after a defeat, after a bad game, well, he had an absolutely tremendous game. Absolutely tremendous game. Beyond his wildest dreams. Over 70 odd messages of racial abuse from over 20 odd accounts. So you're at the you're over the moon. You're ecstatic. And all of a sudden, ever since that day, all you're doing is being hit by monkey emojis, gorilla emojis, banana emojis, the N-word. And just think about having to travel to work to continue to speak about that on a consistent, but yeah, look, here you go. There's another one. Yeah, I'm just reporting another one. Something's going to break sooner rather than later. Something's going to break in a professional sports person. And unfortunately, they're going to be judged on being broken by a system that is not fit for purpose.
Troy, as always, thanks for coming on. Can we wheel you out soon and just talk about football?
I'd love to. I don't think you trust me to talk about football.
Well, that's the thing. Thing. I didn't. Yeah. When you said you could, and also you said you could dissect a game, and we don't want any of that on this.
No, more than happy to. Any stage, you know, I'm always here, Max. So yeah. All right. You know, unfortunately, these things still need to be spoken about, don't they?
Good man, Troy.
All right. Take care, guys.
That'll do for part two. We'll be back in a second. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. It is the 10th anniversary of the Women's Super League. Let's talk to Susie Rack about it. How are you doing, Susie?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, good, thanks. So the FA are going to open a Hall of Fame. Tuesday marked the decade when Arsenal beat Chelsea 1-0 in the top flight's first match. 10 years on, if you look at the quality of the players coming into the WSL, the increase in the coverage, is it ahead, behind where you expected it might be?
That's a good question. I think probably where you would have hoped it would have been, perhaps even a little bit behind. You know, I think plenty of people would have liked to have seen us reach this point and this kind of level of coverage a bit quicker, particularly, you know, the broadcast deal, you know, that we were sort of talking about that at the start of the 10 years and now we've only got it coming in 11 years on next season. That feels a little bit disappointed when I was looking back at the timeline. I found it really hard, actually, to look at 10 years of WSL because it's a bit like 92 with the Premier League in that football didn't exist yeah. before then. And a lot of the stats I'm finding really funny, like how many goals players scored in the WSL as opposed to their entire career and things. It's just a bit bizarre. But I think overall, you know, the fact that at the start of the 10 years you had the semi-professional league and now you've got a fully professional league in the broadest sense of the term. Birmingham have shown how unprofessional the professional league is. That's, yeah, huge step forward. You know, the Barclays deal. I'd say, like, we've really had the main progress in the last about 2 years, really.
And that broadcasting deal is so huge, isn't it? Because it, I was talking to Kelly Simmons yesterday, actually, the head of the professional women's game for the FA, about sort of normalising women's football. So it's just football, and it's not every time there's a women's game at the end of it you have to have a discussion about where is the women's game at now, which I know is the exact discussion we're having this second. The number of people that will watch that, the number of young girls and boys that will watch that, will be sort of more than watch the Premier League on Sky or BT.
Yeah, I can't wait until we're just talking about whether the football is rubbish or not, like just from a footballing point of view, rather than, you know, like discussing where a player was playing when they were 12 and, you know, how influential their big brother was in getting them to play and all those kind of backstories. They're sort of nice for nice features, but when you get them, you know, kind of week in, week out around every single game, it gets a bit tiring when you just want to talk about and analyse football. So I'm sort of looking forward to a point at which where it's so big, where there's so much of it around that we're not having to delve into those little niche topics to try and entice people, that people are already watching it. So they want to talk about what they've watched rather than all this content that is trying to entice people towards the game. So that for me is the exciting part of it. The fact that like it's going to be on BBC One and BBC Two. You know, 10 years ago, ESPN were part of the launch of the WSL and had the some broadcast rights. They agreed to broadcast like 6 games or something like that. And the deal, like very much like the recent one with BT, was they would just cover costs of production and there was no money in it for the league or the teams or the FA. So like the fact that now you've got both that financial commitment, which is mainly coming from Sky, and then also the FA and Sky and the BBC all thinking a little bit bigger picture about it and saying, yeah, actually, we want the BBC on board and we want this on, and we're committing to put it on, you know, BBC One and Two rather than just the red button or the website. So, you know, you don't have to find it. You don't have to seek it out and have to already know it exists to be able to watch it. It's just there and you can switch it on and it's, yeah, great.
Susie, I was thinking about that comparison you made with the Premier League era and when it comes in, everything changes. And thinking about how that actually really changed how England was positioned as a footballing country within Europe. Because prior to that, in the early 90s, was really Serie A heyday. It was Italian football heyday. And things have shifted a lot since then. And I mean, certainly, I can't speak for all over Europe so much, but Italian women's game is some way behind the English women's game. There's been steps forward driven by, as with so much in Italian football right now, certain individual clubs, it feels like Juventus starting to pay attention and put money into it. Do you think the WSL can have the same sort of impact for England as a sort of footballing country in women's football and positioning England as a hub in the same way as perhaps the Premier League has over time really escalated the financial possibilities, certainly for Premier League clubs?
Oh, 100%. I mean, I think it already is doing that a little bit, partly because the league is so competitive. And that's the, like when you've got, like in Italy, where you've got Juventus, Fiorentina sort of getting a little bit left behind, Milan coming on board, like that, you've got the tops of the trees, the top of the league at a very good level, like in France with Lyon and PSG, or Spain with Barca and Atletico, like, and the rest are just sort of very, very routine games every week for those teams. Whereas, you know, you look at the WSL and you've got Brighton ending Chelsea's incredible unbeaten run, and you've got Reading taking points off Man United to hit their chances of Champions League football next season. And that, for me, that's the biggest thing, is that the league overall is getting more competitive. And I think that then drives the desire of clubs in Europe. But then you, on the converse, you've got the fact that obviously in the Champions League, if you've got, say, for Lyon and PSG, just, you know, 2 big games a season in the league, they are able to focus fully on the Champions League. So I think, you know, you've then got the issue of the fact that a competitive league makes it harder for English teams to be successful in the Champions League because they can't, you know, focus all their attention on those games. So you've got a sort of swings and roundabout effect of good league versus good Champions League run.
Which is exactly the conversation we've had at times of the Premier League as well. So in some ways, even that, it's growth, right? Like, it's what it feels like. Sorry, my dog is on one.
Susie, Nikki's dog isn't the only angry man who gets very exercised at talk, or, you know, of this game no one is forcing him to watch. Do you foresee it a time when, because, you know, Alex Scott was appointed presenter of Football Focus yesterday, the comments on the Daily Mail and Daily Mirror, which were the two I had my attention drawn to, were predictably tragic and depressing, and in a way amusing, because it is nice to see people having their piss boiled by something so unimportant. Do you foresee a time when you will be able to write an article about women's football that doesn't have to be pre-moderated or doesn't have comments telling you to get back in the kitchen and stop wasting everyone's time? Or is that just something you're resigned to having to put up with forever?
Good question. I think I'm resigned to having to put up with forever, but I always find it quite funny that people care enough to go online and comment. Like, I think you're always going to get people who, regardless of whether they even think it, are going to do it because it is fun to troll. I think people like being trolls. So I think you're always going to get from that point of view. I found the Alex Scott thing absolutely hilarious because people were slagging off the fact that she apparently hasn't played football when she's, you know, World Cup international, as opposed to Dan Walker, that famous England international. Really, really got me tickled. But yeah, no, I don't think we're ever going to reach a point where we're beyond that. I think it will reduce in that people won't be saying it in a genuine way, but you'll still get, you know, the trolls that just enjoy the wind-ups doing it.
I mean, but I do think that idea, and it might be a generational thing, that for young boys now, women's football will be on TV. It'll exist. It didn't exist when I was 10. Like, there was just nowhere for me to see it. Now, that doesn't mean I'm angry about it existing. It certainly doesn't mean I'm angry about who presents Football Focus. But I maybe that will...
You're still angry about who presents Soccer AM.
But you see my point. Like, there'll be... Hopefully, there'll be fewer, just because it won't be like... There won't be people who are just ingrained and incapable of expanding their mind, I guess.
This is like an imperfect parallel, but I know from... I'm doing less of it these days, but I've covered the NFL for The Guardian for a long time, and I know that the number of comments on NFL articles... When we were first doing NFL articles for The Guardian, there was way more, why is this on this website? And after a while, people do get bored. People just sort of stop doing it. And so I do think that changes over time.
My little brother watched the England game the other night, and he's 6 years old. And he turned to my dad and he said, women aren't very good at football, are they? My dad had to explain, no, that it was just England that weren't very good at football and what sexism was, which opened up a nice chat between them. But yeah, hopefully we'll get to a point where he's watching some games where there's actually some good football played, and that is the effect.
Susie, are there any teams that are not in WSL at the moment that you know, have got sort of strong men's teams that are now looking to sort of pump money into the women's game? Any that we should be looking out for?
Yeah, there's a few. Southampton are putting a lot of work in. They've got Marianne Spacey, the former England international, like running their women's setup and managing their women's team. They're top of the league with the curtailed league at the moment. I think they're in tier 3 or 4. They were top of the league when the season was curtailed last season, so in theory they should be promoted already. And haven't been. And there's a few teams like that. And there's a couple of teams that are really exciting, like Ipswich Town, who are one of the few lower tier women's teams that have a really, really good academy structure, where a lot of like England youth players go and play in the Ipswich first team and are playing in the England youth teams. And that's like quite an exciting team to watch. Watford were responsible for sort of pulling their women's team and refusing to sort of fund them into the semi-professional championship when they were in that league, and they chose to drop down a tier, but now they're battling to get back up. There's a bunch of really great, and Leicester City are coming up this season, next season. They've already won promotion from the championship, and they have been doing loads with their women's team, like really took them, the club took the team sort of more under the wing of the club last season. And they went fully professional in the semi-professional league in preparation for coming up into the WSL. And I think it's going to be great to see them coming up into WSL, because they're really, really, really committed to investing in the team. But they've got Heskey is a ambassador for the side, and is like, you know, putting his arm around the players a little bit and giving them advice and things too. And they've really like integrated them into the setup. So there's a few that are. Are really, really kind of pulling their sides in.
Susie, thanks for coming on. Appreciate it.
No worries. Thanks, guys.
Susie Rack there, the Guardian's women's football correspondent. Finally, Terence says, not a question, but I really relate with the person who said they don't watch games anymore, get their updates via Football Weekly. And he says, and cough, other podcasts. I don't know what that means. I support Manchester United. I will grudgingly watch their games, but absolutely nothing else. Thanks for keeping me informed. This new generation of people who don't see any of the football, and we are their only window into what's happening. We appreciate you greatly. And that'll do.
Yes? Sorry, just, I mean, there's a huge section of Mark Ramone and Simon Mayo's audience who listen to their film podcast but never watch the movies they're talking about. And Ellis, Mike Bubbins and Steph Guerrero's Socially Distant Sports Pod. That's all, well, a lot of it is based on watching documentaries and watching clips, but a huge part of their audience don't watch the clips they're talking about.
Are there any other podcasts you want to recommend, Barry?
I haven't listened to Commode in a while, but I was always one of those people. I barely see any movies, but I used to really enjoy listening to those two just because they bicker and it's fun.
Anyone else want to recommend other podcasts?
I used to enjoy listening to them and now I don't because I just got sick of them. And now I worry that people who used to enjoy listening to us don't anymore because they've got sick of us. So maybe we shouldn't.
Well, I'm sick of it. Anyway, that'll do for today. Barry, thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Nikki.
Thanks, Max.
Cheers, Mark.
Thanks, Max.
We'll be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.